From KCUR News, this is KC Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, hear the story of a treasure-hunting family who discovered a boatload of goods that have become part of Kansas City history. Then college is a time many students find themselves, and for some, that means becoming public about their sexuality. It can be liberating, but it can also mean getting cut off. Hear how UMKC is getting national attention for its approach towards gay and lesbian students.
They took it on up to the Federal Court of Appeals, and lo and behold, they won.
And a new album compiles some classic Kansas City soul and funk.
Now collectors are buying this music. They've zoned in on Kansas City musicians from back in the day.
Listen up for KC Currents just after this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The G20 Economic Summit has opened in St. Petersburg, Russia. Russian President Vladimir Putin is welcoming the leaders of member countries. Although the summit is supposed to focus on the world economy, the unofficial dialogue at the summit will be about Syria. Putin opposes President Obama's call for military action in Syria. The White House blames the Syrian government for a chemical weapons attack against civilians. Members of the House and Senate are getting another classified briefing on Syria today. The meetings come a day after the Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted to support a resolution giving the president authority to conduct a limited strike on Syria. The full Senate is expected to vote next week. The resolution's future in the House is not clear. Meanwhile, in Syria, government troops have retaken a historic Christian town northeast of Damascus after heavy fighting with Islamist rebels. NPR's Rima Marouche reports residents are fleeing the area, fearing another attack.
Residents say the rebel attack began on Wednesday when a suicide bomber from Jabhat al-Nusra, an Islamist brigade, detonated a car bomb next to a government checkpoint at the entrance of the town, Malula. At least 17 soldiers were killed. Heavy clashes followed between rebels and government forces. Amateur videos showed bodies of dead Syrian soldiers lying in pools of blood. Malula is a 4th-century town in the hills of the Qalamun Mountains, 30 miles from Damascus. It is mostly inhabited by one of the oldest Christian communities in Syria. The residents speak one of the dialects of Aramaic, the language of Jesus. Rima Marouche, NPR News, Beirut.
A bombing in Cairo targeted Egypt's interior minister earlier today. NPR's Saraya Sarhadi Nelson reports he survived without injury.
Egyptian bomb squads are examining the scene of the explosion in Nasser City. State-run TV said a bomb was thrown from a building, targeting the convoy of Interior Minister Mohamed Ibrahim as he was leaving home. But a security official says it was a car bomb that detonated on the street near the house. Three cars were destroyed, including two in the convoy. Two shop fronts were also destroyed. The quasi-official Ahram newspaper reported police shot dead two assailants. Egyptian security forces have been a major target of militants since July, when the military ousted President Mohamed Morsi from power. Dozens of policemen have been kidnapped and killed, but the attack on Ibrahim was the first on a member of the interim government. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
Prison officials in Ohio are investigating the suicide of convicted rapist Ariel Castro. He was sentenced to life in prison plus 1,000 years for holding three women captive in his Cleveland home for a decade and sexually abusing them. Castro apparently hanged himself in his cell Tuesday night. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 13 points at 14,944. This is NPR.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. We're broadcasting now live on Thursdays on Central Standard, with a repeat Sundays and Mondays. It was 157 years ago today that a 3-year-old steamboat was traveling up the Missouri River when a piece of driftwood pierced its hull. Nobody was hurt, unless you count a mule tied to the deck. He went down with the ship, and the silt of the river buried the ship away. It wasn't until 1987 that refrigerator repairman Bob Hawley and his sons David and Greg found the ship. They turned the wreckage and its extraordinary contents into the Steamboat Arabia Museum. Today we have on the wife and mother of this treasure-hunting team, Flo Hawley. Thank you so much for joining us, Flo.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
So tell me, how did your husband and sons first get interested in looking for this ship?
I'd also like to mention that we had another friend that we had known for years. His name was Jerry Mackey, and he was kind of the motley crew that decided to do this. I sent my son David on a service call, because that's what our business was heating and air conditioning. But this proved to be very handy because the guys were good with tools. We knew we'd hit water. We knew it would be difficult to keep the water out, to keep the generators going. It takes a good mechanic to pull this off. So thankfully, the guys were good at tools and had a lot of experience in that field. But I sent David on a call, and when he was there, he noticed the map of the Missouri River from St. Louis to Kansas City, and there's about 150 steamboats still out in the cornfields.
That haven't been found yet.
That hadn't been found yet.
Interesting. But they were looking for it. They had in mind that they wanted to find
this.
Well,
not at that point. After that call, I heard him on the radio saying, let's meet at Jerry's for a hamburger. And there they all four were sitting in this booth. And that's where this story began. And so the next 4 or 5 years, we drilled on 5 or 6 boats. And finally, we picked the Arabia, because when we drilled down, we brought up a little red goblet, and it said in our research that the steamboat Arabia had been salvaged, and there was nothing on it. But they were trying to find the whiskey and the cognac, so
who was your husband and sons were trying to find it, or the people who wrote about it?
Well, other people that were writing about it because they wanted to get the whiskey.
Uh-huh.
But my husband's convinced the wives, the reason we were going after it, we were going to find gold bars and silver bars, and we were going to sell everything and build a big house on the hill. Well, all the money we found was 2 dimes, a half dime, and an 1856 penny. That's the year the boat went down.
But you found a lot more stuff that told an incredible
history. We found 220 tons of cargo was on that steamboat.
And your original plan was to sell it all off, right? And then
right.
You could have built that house on the hill.
That's right.
But why didn't you?
It's funny how the process changed as we brought things up and we cleaned them up. Our whole view of history changed. And that's the most wonderful part, is the story that the things that were on the boat, how it changed our lives, and it tells us about our parents and our grandparents, and how self-reliant they were, how talented they were, to go into Indian territory and survive, and to be able to do this on their own without any help from anybody. There were no stores to go to. You ran out of something, you were stuck. You had to build it or create it yourself.
I wonder, after all these years, what's your favorite artifact in the museum?
Everybody asks us about that. We have some beautiful Wedgwood dishes. The first barrel of dishes we found had Wedgwood and cypress from England, and we knew then there was Wedgwood on the Arabia. So that was a pretty exciting night, which was a blessing because we ran out of money. We couldn't get rid of the water. 10 feet down, we hit water. And our pipes went down 65 feet to pump this water out, but 12 pumps didn't do it. So we ran out of money. We were ready to quit, and the guys turned around in a swirl in the middle of the water, and when they went over to find it, they dug it up, and it had 187 pieces of beautiful pottery of Wedgwood and cypress. And we took those dishes home, washed the mud off, called in some friends that we knew had money, and we sold $150,000 in stock that night. And then we were able to buy more pumps, and every time we'd drop a pump down 65 feet, we'd get rid of another foot of water.
But instead of making a killing on this, you wanted to invest more to turn this into a museum.
Yes, that's right. We asked the judge who owned the property. We had signed a lease to sell everything. But when we brought it up, he had school teachers in his family, too. And we knew what a wonderful story it told about my grandma and your grandma. And we asked if we could keep it together, and he said yes. And the only thing they asked for all his family to come in and take maybe a pistol or a gun or a dish, the women took dishes. I think they had 21 pieces go to the Sorter family. So we found a wonderful farmer to deal with.
Well, Flo, Holly, we're going to bring this segment to a close, but how has your life changed since you opened the museum?
How what?
How has your life changed since that
time? Oh, absolutely. I used to be a housewife. I'd never worked on a cash register before, bookwork, anything like that. Now we have this wonderful gift shop, and we're down here every day. We hit the floor every morning at 5. I've been down here since 6 this morning. Our museum closes at 7, 6 at night. We lock her down, but it's just been wonderful. Everybody loves it. I had a lady come up yesterday with tears in her eyes. Mm-hmm. We were both crying before she left. She's here for for a music convention, but everybody loves it.
Flo Holly, thank you so much for joining us. Flo Holly runs the gift shop at the Kansas City Steamboat Arabia Museum. Her sons and husband found the ship in 1987. It went down 157 years ago today. Thank you so much for joining us, Flo.
You're welcome.
The University of Missouri, Kansas City has taken big steps in recent years to become more welcoming to gays, lesbians, and sexually questioning students and staff. Like a lot of universities, the school now considers diversity and inclusion part of its mission, right alongside educating students. But there hasn't always been an attitude of acceptance at UMKC. Casey Current's Alex Smith has the story of the school's LGBT struggle and the legal victory that influenced campuses around the country.
It's 7 o'clock on the dot. I'm in my drop top, cruising the streets.
They took turns at the mic, singing along with party songs or slow jams while the audience cheered.
My name's Heidi Banks, also known as Brian LaFave. I've been here with my sister Monique Hart, and we were just hosting a little karaoke party here.
It's karaoke led by drag queens. But this isn't a bar, and it's not Saturday night. This is college, in the student union, during lunch hour on the second day of class. It's a welcome activity sponsored by a student activities group called LGBTQIA.
That's lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, intersex, and ally. The Q can also stand for questioning, and the A can also stand for asexual.
That's Jonathan Pryor, Programs and Services Coordinator for the LGBTQIA, which is celebrating its 10th year. The group sponsors lots of on-campus activities, but they're just the start of what UMKC has done for the LGBT community in recent years. Same-sex partner benefits for faculty and staff, gender-neutral bathrooms, a full-time programs coordinator, and 3 different scholarships. Campus Pride, which rates universities on gay friendliness, gives UMKC 4.5 out of 5 stars. The programs are also attracting the attention of students like Kayla Wilkerson.
That's one of the reasons why I came to campus, was for the organization.
But wait, how did all this happen at UMKC? After all, it's a small state school in part of a country that's not known as especially socially progressive. Changing cultural attitudes probably have a lot to do with the gay-friendly policies, but long before Anderson Cooper or Will and Grace or NBA player Jason Collins, it took a fight to get a gay and lesbian group on campus. The school's hidden gay history has long fascinated faculty and alumni like film professor Tom Poe, librarian Stuart Hines, and Ross Fries, who leads gay and lesbian history tours. They recall the story, which started in 1971.
There was a student group that ended up calling themselves the Gay People's Union.
That's film professor Tom Poe.
They were claiming they wanted to be like a study group that could have speakers come in that could simply discuss issues around gay rights.
They wanted to be able to use facilities on campus and get campus funding like, you know, other student groups.
And that's Ross Fries.
They asked the administration to have their group recognized as an official student group here at UMKC, and the administration said, no way.
Actually, the language from the university was a little stronger than that. In 1973, the University of Missouri Board of Curators rejected both the Gay People's Union and a similar group at MU called Gay Lib. It said that recognizing these groups would lead to increased violations of the state's sodomy laws. Stuart Hines of the Gay and Lesbian Archives of Mid-America explains the resolution passed by the board.
Officials found that were Gaylib to be recognized formally, that would, quote, expand an abnormal way of life, turn latent homosexuals into overt ones, and enable the sick and abnormal to counsel others who are similarly ill and abnormal.
And in fact, use language in which they call these students criminals, mentally ill.
The activities that they were undertaking were socially repugnant. Recognition would deem homosexuality as normal behavior rather than causing homosexuals to seek medical treatment for the medical illness of homosexuality.
That same year, in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association actually declassified homosexuality as a mental illness.
And so the two student groups went together and sued the whole University of Missouri system to sort of force them to give them their right of freedom of speech and assembly guaranteed by the Constitution.
The gay groups lost in all those early battles, but they took it on up to the Federal Court of Appeals. I think it was the 8th District. And lo and behold, they won.
That court said that the University of Missouri had to allow UMKC and MU Columbia students that were gay and lesbian and their supporters to be able, in fact, to meet in the campus union.
The federal 8th District Court of Appeals decision also required the universities to provide funding. The court issued its ruling on Gaylib versus the University of Missouri in 1977, but it wasn't quite the end of the legal battle.
The university decides to take it to the Supreme Court in 1977, but ultimately they decided not to formally hear the case. The university again repetitions the Supreme Court, and once again they are turned down in April of the following year, April of 78.
And so because of that lawsuit, gay groups around the country and institutions of higher learning could be recognized, legally recognized as legitimate student groups. And it's all because of the gay group in Mizzou and the gay group here at UMKC.
It was not the first federal case over gay student groups, but it was an influential one. The case was cited in later decisions that allowed gay student groups in Texas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. And at UMKC, the Gay People's Union finally became an official student group. But then something surprising happened. By the 1980s, after spending most of a decade trying to get recognized, the LGBT group at UMKC disappeared. Because no one stepped up to lead, there was no gay or lesbian group on campus for about 10 years. Finally, in 1999, the Gay and Lesbian Student Alliance was formed. That was followed by the Queer Alliance and then the Pride Alliance, which is still around today. UMKC formed the LGBTQIA separately as part of student affairs in 2003.
Hello there.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
It's hot and sweaty and gross. So, yeah.
A couple of days after the karaoke, the LGBTQIA held its welcome ice cream social in the quad. Hundreds of students turned out to show support, or at least get free ice cream. It's an attempt to take on what Tom Poe believes is the group's biggest new challenge, making sure LGBT is for everyone.
I do think that the one thing which still happens is that all these centers, but it could be true of the Women's Center or the African American House, is that while necessary, they do kind of segregate, I think, in some ways, students who, if you're not a part of that, then it's nothing to you. I even find that sometimes in curriculum. Oh, if you have a class on, say, LGBT representations in media, oh, well, that would be of interest to gay students, but if I'm a straight student, why would I take that class? So what's going to be more important is, I think, to also kind of keep these centers and these services, but also to integrate that into the wider campus community.
UMKC is still expanding services for LGBT faculty, staff, and students. Jonathan Pryor says the university is now exploring a preferred name policy for transgendered students and gender-neutral housing. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
We're going to take a short break. After that, we'll meet a young woman who found herself suddenly unable to pay for college after she came out. And we want to hear your stories. You can call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or tweet us at Casey Currents. You're listening to Casey Currents. Welcome back to Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. As we just heard in Alex's piece, UMKC has come a long way from prohibiting gay and lesbian groups on campus to being named a couple of times as one of the most gay-friendly schools in the country. One of the innovative things the school is doing is offering scholarships to LGBT students. That's because when some college students come out of the closet, they face the danger of being cut off financially from their parents. That's what happened to recent UMKC graduate Courtney Monzik. She's joining us over the phone. Good morning, Courtney.
Morning.
Thank you for sharing your story with us. I wonder if you can tell us how did you end up coming out when you came to UMKC?
I was actually outed instead of coming out. I did my first semester at Mizzou, and my best friend from high school thought that I was going down the path of sin and decided to tell my parents that I was in a relationship with a girl.
And she outed you to your parents?
Yes.
And how did they react?
Not very well. It was right before spring break, and so I went down for the week-long spring break, and I got a two-hour talking to about how I was going straight to hell and that I was being selfish because I was taking myself away from my parents in heaven. And my mom kept crying throughout the whole thing. My dad wouldn't really look at me. He left after the conversation. And then at the end of spring break, my dad gave me a book called Restoring Sexual Identity, Hope for Women with Same-Sex Attraction, and asked me if my then-girlfriend would like a copy as well.
What was that like for you? I mean, was it similar on campus, or did you have kind of a different reaction on campus?
On campus, when I came to UMKC, I was a very out person. I ended up coming out myself the following November. UMKC, it was just, you know, very welcoming. The majority of the people that I met had no issues with how I identified, and being very out about it, I was very active. I was the secretary for who's then called the Queer Alliance, and then I also did a lot of panels for different classes, and I did a panel in my own class, and everybody was just really accepting. They're just kind of like, you know, who you are. So there was no change in how most people interacted with me.
And where do your parents live?
They live in Washington, Missouri. It's about 45 minutes southwest of St. Louis.
And that's where you grew up?
Most of it, yeah.
Did you wish you had been able to talk to them later or maybe even not talk to them at all about this?
I wish that I had been able to tell them when I was ready for it. I did grow up in a very small town, and there were no out lesbians, so there were no role models. It wasn't even, my family is also very religious, so it wasn't even a consideration for me. I had friends that were gay, but to me, it was like, yeah, that's fine for them, but I didn't think I could be gay. I always knew something was off, something was different. It wasn't. Was and everything made sense.
Right. Did you expect that your parents would then cut you off financially from paying for your education?
I didn't expect them to. They had told, I'm one of four kids, and they had told all of us that we'd have our first 4 years completely paid for. And when I changed my major my first semester, my parents reminded me that they were only going to pay for my first 4 years. Then, after the completion of the semester in which I got outed, I was told that they weren't going to anything any more schooling. Said that it was because the market that they weren't able to do so. But later, when I was talking to my mom, seeing if they could, you know, cover $700 that my student loans didn't cover, she asked me if I had realigned myself since coming up to Kansas City. And that's when I'm sure that the real reason why they had quit paying. Also, since they paid for all 4 years of my older sister going to Mizzou, and they're paying in year two of my younger sister going to university as well.
We're just cutting out, I think. We're not hearing you. But what did you do then when you found out that you weren't going to have the money to pay?
I took out student loans. I got started job hunting. It took me a little while to find a job, and I finally got a work-study position on campus. And just really watched my budget. I was told, while I was telling the then coordinator of the LGBT services what was going on and things that were happening with my parents and my funding, and he told me about LGBTQ hardship scholarship. And so I applied for that. It went to somebody else who needed it more than I did. But I did also get some other scholarships as well.
Right. And do you think that knowledge of your situation was part of why you got those scholarships?
I do. I also worked with a lot with the community, with 18 over LGBT, and the work that I did with them, I was recognized with UMKC, and I was the first recipient of the newly created LGBT UMKC scholarship.
Courtney, what's your relationship with your parents like now?
My dad and I have come to an understanding of we're not going to see eye to eye on it. He has told me that he will never change his opinion on how he sees it. My mom kind of goes back and forth on how well she's accepting it. It just kind of depends on, I guess, other stressors as well. But it's improved with my mom, and I don't really foresee it improving with my dad.
Well, Courtney Monzik is a UMKC student. We really appreciate your sharing your story with us and with our audience. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
What was the climate like for LGBT students when and where you went to school, Kansas City? We want to hear your story. Did you or someone you know not come out because of the fear that their parents would stop supporting them in college? Share your experience at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can comment on KCUR's Facebook page. Joining us to talk more about UMKC programs for LGBT students are Christy Rugin, Assistant Vice Chancellor at UMKC. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Pryor, who's coordinator for LGBTQIA programs and services at UMKC. Jonathan, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I wonder about this experience that Courtney had. Jonathan, how often do you hear about this happening to students at UMKC or elsewhere?
We hear about it more often than we'd like. You know, it's not every day that we have these situations come up, but, you know, clearly we have these scholarships available for our students for a reason, and that there's definitely a need. I think the work that Christy does on campus is so important to assist our students when we have these kind of instances come up.
Christy, when were these scholarships created?
Our first scholarship breakfast was held in October of 2008, and it really did grow out of hearing anecdotal stories, you know, of students leaving campus, leaving college because their parents had abandoned them financially, as well as kicking them out of their homes. And so we really wanted to address this need. Any student who leaves the campus is a loss to us, and particularly LGBTQ students, because they add to the diversity of the institution, the kinds of dialogues we have in classes, the kinds of innovative ideas that can happen. So we really wanted to address that. And that first breakfast, you know, it was a dare. It was sort of one of those things where we just jumped in and said, we're going to do this. You know, whatever we raise, we raise. It was a huge success.
And it was a fundraising breakfast.
It was a fundraising breakfast. Every dollar raised from table sales and personal donations went to student scholarships, student emergency funds.
And just taking a step back, I wonder, I don't know, is there anybody on staff? I don't know if, Jonathan, in your role you'd do that, or probably a lot of staff members end up talking to students about this situation of whether to come out on campus and how to. Jonathan, I mean, who often talks to students about that?
You know, one of my primary roles would be to serve as that resource for our students. But ideally, we would love to see every faculty and staff member be that support for our students. One of the programs that I'm in charge of is Safe Space Training, which is designed to establish allies on campus for our LGBTQIA students.
to help foster that safe space in all areas on campus. So this allows faculty and staff members to mark themselves as allies to our students, often by putting some kind of visible marker on their space that signals to students that I'm a person who you can come to if you need to know about more about resources. Now, of course, these people, and we're not trained to be counselors, and we have a great counseling support staff here at UMKC, so that would be another primary resource that we would send our students to. But ultimately, we would love to see as many faculty and staff members be that first person that a student goes to if they feel comfortable having that conversation with our students.
And it was a surprise to me when I heard once that and read that Dan Savage, the famous sex advice columnist and also an activist for gay and lesbian issues, he said that he kind of regretted telling a college student that you should always come out and that it may be the best thing for students to sometimes wait till after they graduate. But it somehow seems wrong in a way because it's like denying your identity. And I wonder how you talk to students about that.
You know, a student's coming out is a very personal decision, and it's something that I don't think anyone should be pressured to come out. We know that there are positive effects that can come with coming out and having, this sense of dignity, pride, and empowerment. But we also know that there are detrimental things that could take place, such as loss of support from family. And, we do have a lot of students who may be out on campus because campus provides a safe space and they have a community here, and this community is far removed from home. And so, every student may be in a different place when they're coming out, and that's something we would never encourage them to do unless they're ready to make that step and know that they have resources here on campus and in the Kansas City community to help them process that.
You're listening to Casey Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. We're joined by Jonathan Pryor, coordinator for LGBTQIA programs and services at UMKC, and Christy Rugin, assistant vice chancellor at UMKC. We're discussing coming out in college and want to know from you, how did you make the decision of when and how to come out, and how has that decision impacted your life? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Now, kids are coming out at younger ages now. Maybe it's not so much of a college experience. Is that right?
I think it's fair to say that LGBT youth are coming out younger and younger. But it's also important to remember that college is a developmental way of processing time for all our students. So heterosexual or LGBTQIA, everyone is processing their identities. And so college is still a very important time for people who are discovering their gender and sexual identities.
And we just heard from Courtney about this huge disconnect between the way she felt she was embraced on campus and how she was challenged and really kind of rejected in some ways at home. And I wonder what that disconnect is like for students.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be very discouraging, and that's why we're very passionate about providing these resources of support for our students and through many different channels on campus, not just through my office, but Christy as well provides a great support for a lot of our students. And I think that's one thing that makes UMKC special, in that we have multiple areas within our university that is providing support for LGBTQIA.
Christy.
I think, too, that, lots of us are in situations where our home communities, our families have not been able to accept our decisions, who we are, identities. And so university time is actually a wonderful time to create new families, too. And that's one of the things I think is really exciting and wonderful to see with LGBTQ students, is that they are really establishing relationships, choosing new families. And, that doesn't mean that they can't maintain relationships with their biological families. But they're finding resources. They're creating a connection with others that helps them be resilient and fill the support they need in order to graduate, to move on, to continue to be successful. And Christy, what do you think really accounts for UMKC getting such high rating as a gay-friendly school? I would think you're doing what a lot of schools do to varying degrees. Are there some things that you're doing a lot more than other schools do?
Actually, you'd be surprised at the number of schools that don't have an LGBTQIA coordinator. And so Jonathan's role is really critical to, I think, that rating, as well as having restrooms that are
gender-neutral restrooms,
courses on campus that allow for students to explore identity, space on campus as well. So there are many resources that that organizations look at when they review institutions, and UMKC has a lot of them.
And was it a surprise that UMKC scored so high, or did you know that you were really focusing on this?
I think the first year that we were in the top 10, I was a little surprised because we are still in the Midwest. And, you think about LGBTQ-friendly schools as residing on the coast, and that's often what we think about. But to have it be right here in the center of the United States is a little surprising and exciting.
And how unusual are those scholarships?
Actually, I don't know of any scholarship in the country that does quite what we're doing with the LGBTQ Empowerment Scholarship. These emergency funds are not based on academic test scores or GPA. They're really, really just about supporting students staying in school.
Are there people on campus or you know, in Jeff City, it is a state school, who question the university funding students in this way? I mean, I would think it's controversial.
We've been fortunate so far. You know, certainly there are people in the community that have asked questions like, why do these scholarships exist? But nothing from a political, sort of a larger legislative discussion. I think people understand that there are many scholarships available to all kinds of students, and this is just one of them that meets the needs of another student population in the state of Missouri.
Jonathan, in the story we heard, it was all about students getting the right to start gay and lesbian, transgender, and bisexual clubs, mm-hmm. and the recognition from the university. But now a lot of the activities are actually run by the university, and I wonder if some students wonder if that's taking some of the control away from the students. I mean, you work for the university and coordinating these activities.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question, but we also have a very active student population. And so the current organization is Pride Alliance, and you know, they work closely with me. I do advise them, but they're also an independent student organization that is allowed to take on efforts of their own and at their own interest. Additionally, our students are bringing in the Midwest Bisexual, Lesbian, Gay, Transgender Ally College Conference, which is going to bring roughly 2,200 LGBT youth from the Midwest colleges to Kansas City in February. And that's a student-driven initiative, nothing to do with me. And so our students are definitely very engaged and active on campus while, you know, there are a lot of efforts being put on by the university, because I think that's, you know, symbolizing how important the administration views support for LGBTQIA students.
I wonder, I mean, the past few years have seemed to be a huge shift in public, this overall public opinion. You hear all these politicians talking about their evolution in thinking about right. these issues. But college campuses have been ahead of the game, but I wonder what's changed in the past few years on college campuses.
Yeah, I think you're seeing more of these offices like my role pop up, but it is still very rare. I think our culture is shifting, and that we're listening more to our students' needs and realizing that our LGBTQIA students have real concerns that we need to provide these services and resources. I think you could also attribute that some of that to media and popular culture and more visibility of LGBT people and youth. Looking at popular television shows like Glee and how LGBT people are represented, I think that's providing a better awareness of issues that LGBT people face, like bullying, harassment, and suicide.
And at the same time, I think it's really interesting that as LGBTQ characters are seen publicly as people who've come out who are in popular culture, we have to accept, too, that there's going to be some backlash. And we definitely are seeing that. You know, there's the Gay Lesbian Straight Education Network's 2011 data tells us that students in K-12 are still experiencing horrible bullying. The amount of time they spend out of school because they're afraid, the number of times they hear negative comments about LGBTQ people, the fact that teachers and staff aren't interrupting those conversations, you know, those are the things that students come to college with. And remember, they're the same students that they went to high school with or coming to college with them often. And so they will experience some of that at any institution that they attend. So while things have gotten better, we still have so much to address.
Is that something that you're thinking about a little bit on how to provide some support for students even before, you know, in their high school or earlier years?
I think Gay-Straight Alliances help to create some dialogue in high schools before they come to college. I think when universities are seen as being places where we are accepting, supportive, that we don't tolerate discrimination, you know, I think students are having to come to these institutions prepared, but we still, I think, experience some of those same things that high school students are experiencing.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us. We were joined today by Assistant Vice Chancellor Christy Rugin and Jonathan Pryor, Coordinator for LGBTQIA Programs and Services, both at UMKC. Thank you so much for your time. Coming up, soul and funk recordings made here in Kansas City in the 1960s and 70s are coveted finds for record collectors around the world. But a new compilation is going to make them much more available. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. This month, a Chicago record label is releasing a compilation of funk and soul songs originally put out by a Kansas City label in the late 1960s and 70s. Eccentric Soul, the Forte label, comes out this week on vinyl and CD. Probably the best-known voice on the compilation is that of KCK native Marvo Whitney, who passed away late last year. Before joining the Forte label and marrying its founder, Ellis Taylor, Marva Whitney was soul sister number one to soul brother number one, James Brown. Joining us in the studio today to talk about the Forte label and the Kansas City musicians who recorded on it are Chuck Haddix, host of KCUR's Friday and Saturday Night Fish Fry and director of UMKC's Mar Sound Archive, Alan Bell, an immigration lawyer who was a theatrical agent at the time, and Eugene Smiley, a blues and R&B musician who was part of the scene back in the 60s and 70s. Thank you all for joining us.
Well, glad to be here with you, Sylvia.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Very appreciative that you invited me.
Let me just start with you, Chuck. You've been helping the Chicago-based Numero label with their research on Forte. Why were they interested in this pretty obscure local record label?
That's really their specialty. They focus upon regional soul labels and funk labels that are associated with specific towns. And they make these available and really repackage them and do a wonderful job of researching those labels, too, because this is a time when not so much has been written about these particular labels. And they go back in and locate the people that are associated with them, do a wonderful job of reissuing this classic soul that really never reached the national audience. And all of a sudden, they're bringing it back.
Hmm. And why were they interested in the Forte label in Kansas City?
Well, you know, Dante, who's in Chicago.
And, Dante Carfagna, record collector.
And James Trotter had been doing some pioneering research into the Forte label. This is right up their alley because here you have a very specific time period, 1967, 1977, and you have the evolution of a soul, of basically what started as a soul label, into kind of a funky label. Of course, you know, you had, you know, Soul Queen number one, Marva Whitney. And so it's a very defined body of work, and they go in and select the best and make it available to get. You know, some of these recordings sell for thousands of dollars in the Northern Soul market.
And who
They're
is
extremely
buying it?
Rare. Mostly DJs from England, collectors from Japan. These are some of the rarest recordings, soul recordings made.
And Eugene Smiley, you were a musician and yes. are a musician still, but at the time that these recordings were made, is it surprising to you that they became so popular in this sort of DJ scene?
It's shocking. Tell the truth about it. We have a lot of music that was done back in the day that are now selling, especially overseas, are selling for a lot of money, you know.
And I understand some of it was just piled up in people's garages, and people didn't know that anybody really wanted to hear it because some of these records weren't that successful when they first came out.
For instance, my record, I had no idea that it was as valuable as it was until I one day came home and my wife laid a sheet out on it and said, this record is your record. It's over $1,175.
Wow. And Alan Bell. Now, did you know Ellis Taylor, who founded this Forte record label?
I knew him very well. He was the technical director, I believe, at KMBZ Radio. And to some extent, he might have done some technical direction work, if you will, on the companion KMBC TV. I visited him there at 11th and Wyandotte in his office many times. He was an executive. He was what I call a black pioneer in that field in Kansas City. He was very business-oriented. He was a sharp guy.
But also, you know, Ellis was, he was an engineer at KPRS.
Right.
One of the pioneering KPRS. African-American stations. And at that time,
Carter Broadcasting.
Right, exactly. At that time, KPRS was on the right end of the dial.
Hmm.
And, you know, they would play these records. He could get airplay. And he saw groups like, for example, Motown get established, Stax Records get established. And all a label, startup label needed was one national hit to get established. For example, the Marquees with Last Night.
You got it.
Established the Stax Records. It gave them the capital to record other artists and to develop their stable. Unfortunately, that really eluded Ellis. You know, what's so interesting to me about these recordings is these are every bit as good as a lot of the recordings became national hits. For example, The Hen with Louis, what's that, Cashier. You know, it's a wonderful instrumental.
Yes.
And this is the time of the great instrumentals, too. Any of these could have established a label, really, because they're all quality recordings. They're all kind of like lost gems. But Ellis just never got the hit that established the label. But, I mean, he persisted for 10 years. And also, if you look at this body of work, it reflects the evolution of the music at that time. You've got the Rayons, which is, you know, the group, you know, sound. And then down here, you've got Everyday People doing Super Black, you know, from 1972. And, you know, that's the time when James Brown's recording, I'm Black and I'm Proud.
Oh, yeah. Until this earth was born, one property of scorn. A man who's back, strong and straight. From his country he was born. Middle of peace of life, without all the pain and strife. Returned to a white man's slave, to work his life away.
Now, Smiley, you were pretty young at the time, the 1960s, and just breaking into the music scene. What kind of music were people into then in the mid-60s?
Mainly R&B and soul. That's what all the musicians was into back at that time. Blues was there, but it wasn't quite as effective as R&B. Back in the day, you actually felt the music, you know. You had the music that made you feel like you wanted to jump, and you had the music that made you want to drink.
And would a lot of people come out to gigs by a local band?
Oh, yes. We used to have a place where we gigged, like the Porty House on 31st and, 31st and Gillum?
Yes, then you have La Fiesta at 40th and Troost, 41st and Troost, owned by a guy named George Tadona, it's worth mentioning. There were definitely those events and those places in the 50s, throughout the 50s and early 60s, but I would call it a segregated situation. I would call it an all-black crowd. Basically, white people did not go to those places until maybe, would you say, the late 60s? What would you say?
I would say it started in the late 60s, and the two came together.
This is Casey Currents on 89.3 KCUR. We're talking about the re-release of the Kansas City Forte record label. The biggest artist to record with Forte was Marva Whitney. Tell me, Smiley, was it clear when she started performing in the mid-60s that she was going to be kind of a breakout star for Kansas City?
Well, we all felt that. We all felt that she was going to make it to the top.
What was it about her?
she just had it. I mean, it was a natural. When she walked on stage from start to finish, it was showtime. It's my thing. I can do what I want to do.
She comes from a gospel background, and she brought that fever and that delivery and that passion and that soul to the music. And that's what the appeal is.
Marva Whitney got together with Ellis Taylor, professionally and personally. When she returned to Kansas City after 3 years performing with James Brown, she was on top of the world, but also endured a lot, right, Chuck?
James Brown was abusive.
Yes.
He was an abusive band leader. I mean, you know, you hate to say it about somebody that's my hero, but he was a tyrant as a band leader.
Yes, he was.
Let's talk about some of the lesser-known performers here on the Forte label. Alan Bell, tell me about Lee Harris. You were his agent.
Lee was a handsome man, a very good guitarist and bass player. He performed in Europe. We did some bookings at different jazz festivals called Berlin Jazz Festival and so on.
Hey, look here.
I understand Lee Harris wrote some of these songs, too. Also some of the songs performed by some of the other musicians here.
No, he was a very, very talented fellow, is all you can say. Yeah, yeah. Set my heart at ease. You're so fine.
You're so nice. You know I won't. Is there anyone still around that will benefit financially from this re-release?
Maybe. James Whitney.
One thing about the Numero Uno group, unlike a lot of the labels out of Europe, they pay royalties, and they make a point to track down the artists' families to make sure they get paid for it.
Yeah.
And Ellis Taylor Jr. certainly will benefit from this.
That's his son.
Yeah.
That's his son.
And one of the reasons Marva had been burned quite a bit by labels reissuing her material and then not paying her for it. And so she was a little skeptical when Rob and the rest of the gang approached her about it.
That's that Numero.
Yeah, the Numero, the guys from Numero approached her. She got Dwayne Gilley on the job, and he's like a bloodhound. He he checked them out real good, and he said, "Hey, this would be a good thing." And I think I like the quote he told Ellis Jr. He said, "Well, would you rather have the money or not?"
But I understand Marva kind of held up the process a bit to make sure that everybody got paid, even if it took money out of her own pocket.
Right.
Smiley, do you have a pick here from this compilation?
I was listening to Gene Williams last night. I don't need no sympathy. Gene Williams was a great singer, but nobody knew that, you know.
Not even then?
No, not even then.
Does it surprise you to hear it topping off this
album?
It
did. It really surprised me. To hear that music, it was something else last night. There's great music on that. Broke back old memories.
These are good times.
It stands the test of time.
Chuck Haddix is host of The Fish Fry, heard here on KCUR on Friday and Saturday nights, also director of the Mar Sound Archives at UMKC. Eugene Smiley is a local blues and R&B musician, and Alan Bell is an immigration lawyer and former theatrical agent. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for having us.
The Chicago-based Numero record label is re-releasing a compilation of songs from Kansas City's Forte label this week on CD and vinyl. The record store Zebedee's on 39th Street will be celebrating the release with performances by Eugene Smiley and some of the original musicians on the label Saturday afternoon at 2. Find more information and some historic photos on our website at kcur.org. Thanks for tuning in to Casey Currents. Our live broadcast will be happening right here on Thursday mornings from now on. If you missed part of the show, want to hear it again, or subscribe to our podcast, check out our page at kcur.org. You can contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents. Central Standard returns tomorrow with the food critics, and Up to Date is next with the ethics professors and an analysis of the strings attached gift to Children's Mercy. Today's Casey Currents was produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Alex Smith, Suzanne Hogan, and Susan Wilson. Our interns are Monica Sandretsky, Ross Steinmetz, and Sydney Llewellyn. Theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. This is KCUR.